Hi, I'm Kevin Flynn, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today we're talking about episode 3 of the team's latest series on The State versus Jason Carroll, which deals with the 1988 murder of Sharon Johnson of Bow, New Hampshire. If you haven't listened to that episode yet, this conversation may not make a whole lot of sense, so make sure to go back and do that before listening on. Our guests today are Amber Hunt, the host of Crimes of the Century, a history meets true crime podcast on the Obsessed Network, and Accused from the Cincinnati Inquirer, for which she reinvestigates old cases in search of new leads, and one of my very favorite people in the whole podcasting world. Amber, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Likewise.
And Robbie Ashadri is the lead investigator and one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast. And if you didn't know that, then you probably are not listening to the right podcast.
You're in the wrong place.
You're in the wrong place. Robbie, thank you for joining my podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. And I'm so excited that Amber's here. Amber, congratulations on wrapping up season one of A Crimes of the Centuries. I love that show so much.
Thank you. It's been really fun. And I've never been a big history student, and suddenly, because I'm coming at it from the true crime angle, I'm learning all kinds of stuff, and it's just fascinating.
I mean, the most exciting stuff in history is usually criminal stuff. So, yeah, but I can imagine the amount of research it takes. And you have a new Accused series coming up, right?
I do. So we finished the season of Crimes of the Centuries, and I took a few weeks so that I could shift over to write the next season of Accused, the drafts of which are done. So, yeah.
Awesome.
So season four, I think Wondery has this coming out in January, but that's because I don't get a say in such things.
Do we get a hint at all of what this might be dealing
with? Yeah.
This one is, it feels like a lot of pressure, honestly, because this is a death penalty case.
Ah, okay.
So it's, yeah, and that's the first for us.
Wow, okay. Well, again, also, Amber, thank you for joining the two of us here. Rabia, you begin episode 3 with a look at the Robert Briest case. Now, when I heard that you were doing something in New Hampshire, I thought it was going to be this case, the Priest case.
No way, really?
I immediately thought of that because there was some exculpatory evidence, right?
I mean, calling it exculpatory is a bit of a stretch. They ran the victim's DNA, you know, obviously like years after she had been, decades after she'd been murdered. But it wasn't that his DNA wasn't found. It was that there was other DNA also,
right.
You know, somewhere in the evidence. I don't know exactly where. I don't know deeply the details. So it wasn't enough to exonerate him in that it's not that there was DNA found that belonged to somebody else, but his was excluded. His DNA was also part of it. However, it is interesting to me that, number one, he's maintained his innocence for so long, including offers in which he could have gone home. He rejected them because he said it. But then on the other hand, you have the fact that this is like his girlfriend had disappeared. Her body was found 20 years later. The girl his girlfriend was tutoring disappeared. I mean, like there's some stuff there. And, you know, and then they found, you know, fibers from the victim's coat in his car. I mean, there seems to be some. But again, this is the kind of stuff you get when you read newspaper articles. Sometimes you go digging and what's reported is not exactly the truth. So, yeah, it's hard for me to make a complete determination on that case. But it's a freaky coincidence.
Yeah.
Why is it when they maintain their innocence, even when they have been offered clemency or, you know, parole or whatever? Why does that stick out with you as being so important?
It's not that it's so important. I think, I think if a person accepts a plea in order to get out, that does not mean they're necessarily guilty. I think that happens all the time. Cases get pled, people plead guilty when they are not guilty. But I think when somebody is like rejects an offer, right? To me, that's a little more telling than accepting an offer. Like there's a distinction there. Rejecting an offer requires like there's some kind of conviction, like internal conviction in that person that's that's directing them to like not take the opportunity for their freedom. I mean, which is kind of, so many people, innocent people, will do it, you know, just so they can have their freedom, because freedom is that important. So that's what gives me pause in this case. And there's a difference between like how I read the two situations.
I was just curious. In the upcoming season, that is part of what stumps me too, is that our guy could probably argue to get off death row, but he will not say that he did it. So,
wow. I would love to. I mean, look, I'm here to talk about this anytime you want, offline.
Well, one of the most interesting things about the Breese case and the, we'll call it the Sharon Johnson case, is that there is a connection between the victims that I didn't even know about. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Susan Randall, who was the victim in the Robert Breese case that Breese is serving time for, was an 18-year-old student, and apparently her and Sharon Johnson were best friends when they were in high school together. And in one of the newspaper articles, in which one of Sharon's many close friends was telling the papers, like, you know, everybody else recounts the last time they saw a victim, and this woman, Helene, said the last time she saw her was on the 4th of July. Sharon had come over to watch fireworks with Melanie, and they had been ironically talking about Susan Randall, who was one of, you know, like they were just remembering her, and mm-hmm, they still yeah. thought about her. And so Susan had been killed 16 years prior.
So I don't know if either of you have your phone with you, but I'm about to text the two of you what I think is the all-time coolest trial photo from the state of New Hampshire, which comes from the Breese case. This is when they were on the View for the jury, and this is 1971. And of course, it's going to be hard to describe this on the podcast. I'm just going to say I'm going to put this photo.
You don't have to describe it because it's our title image for this week's episode.
No, sir. Is it?
It is. You might not know that, though. It doesn't show up on every app, I think. But yeah. I love that picture. I love that picture.
And I don't know, Amber, if you have your phone.
I do.
Okay. Well, I just sent it to you. I don't know if you could see this. And I'm going to tweet this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
Kevin
I did
B.
see
Flynn.
That.
Right. So it's Robert
Breese.
It's
iconic.
Breese. Yeah. Yeah. He's on the Amiskeg Bridge, and he's got this – he looks like Columbo or Beretta with this cigarette that he's holding in his mouth. He's wearing this fur coat where he's more like a Muppet. It's so 1970s. So sort of 1970s Starsky and Hutch noir. I just love it. Okay. But we have this
– it looks like something out of a movie, right? But yeah.
Right,
so,
yeah.
Yeah, this image really struck me. And actually, Rebecca's the one who sent me this image, but I'd seen it before. I remember seeing this years ago, and I did not remember at the time that this was actually from this case. But yeah, it's an iconic image, and it's I thought it fit perfectly, especially since the title of this episode was Shoe Leather.
Right. So let's get into that, because where we left off, there was a big piece of evidence, or the clue that had not been discovered yet in the early days of the investigation, and that is what happened to Sharon Johnson's car. And so we get an answer. We get an answer to that question that raises more questions. Rabia, tell us about where the car was found.
So when they found Sharon's body, her car was nowhere in the vicinity of the crime scene. It also wasn't where they thought she might have last been. Ken had, the morning her body was discovered, asked Ken Johnson had asked his brother-in-law, Ken Eaton, to go to all the different local stores that Sharon would frequent to see if her car was there somewhere. Eaton had checked it out. Car wasn't there. Then the next morning, early, like really early, like before 6 a.m. early, her car was discovered in the parking lot at the Mall in New Hampshire, close to the Sears entrance. And that it did raise a lot of questions, because that was a parking lot that had been searched more than once the day before.
Right. And, you know, overnight, there are very few, if any, cars out in the parking lot. So it seems really unlikely that an officer before that would have done a patrol and not seen it. So, Amber, when we look at sort of this, you know, mystery, we have to wonder where the car came from and at what time, because it does play an awful lot into answering what might have happened with Sharon right before she disappeared or immediately afterwards. Right? So what questions, you know, does the discovery of the car raise for you?
I think the biggest question I had was about the discrepancy over what Ken was up to Friday night? He was home all night, or did he go for a walk, or which of those is true? There's a lot in this case where you're like, God damn, if it were just a little bit later, we probably would have, you know, surveillance images at least of, you know, this parking lot, so we could know for sure that that car wasn't there on Thursday night or Friday. Yeah, but if it wasn't there, nobody moves a dead woman's car for non-nefarious reasons.
Right. Right. And I always think about when, you know, moving a car, and, you know, there was, again, when I look at Robbie, I'm always reminded of a very famous case which shall go unnamed, in the discovery of a car in an odd place. But it does imply, well, you know, it does make one wonder if there was a second person, only because of the logistics of the transportation. Somebody would have to get to the original place of the car and then drive that car. But once they leave the car, what happens? Are they walking back? Are they not being seen at that hour? Or do they jump in a car with a second person? I mean, these are the questions that I think that, right, investigators had to try to pull apart in the early days, right? And I think, is this also going to play a role in the investigation a year down the road as they try to put together what happens, Rob?
Yeah, and we're actually going to get to how that scenario could have viably happened by episode 5. It's not as hard as you think when you think about, for example, an area like a mall that has lots of other strip store, like, you know, like strip malls around it and shopping centers mm-hmm. around it. And there's an auto plaza. I mean, like, imagine the various places a car could be tucked. That's actually not that far away. But I think Amber raises one of the most salient points here. Like, whenever somebody lies to investigators, the real question is, it's not so much about like trying to unpack the lie, but about like, why are they lying, right? So mm-hmm. Ken clearly lied about that night. Two people, his own brother and then Sharon's brother, knew that he called Sharon's brother from this other house and said, I'm out at this friend's house. And his own brother said the same thing. Then the people at the house also confirmed it. So we know he was out that night. Everybody has distinct memories of that of it being that very day. It was reported very shortly thereafter to the police that Ken had been out. So when they ask Ken, the question is, what are you trying to hide? Are you trying to hide that you walked to your neighbor's house? That's not what you're trying to hide. There's nothing to hide there. So what are you hiding about that night? And not only what are you hiding, but you're so emphatic that you're offering to like even give the police like witnesses, right? Like he's really tripling down on that, right? He's like, no, yeah. Like, I can prove it. So it was that important to him to prove it.
Yeah. And Amber, look, if the car up to that point had been sufficiently hidden, would you not try to infer that at this point the killer wants the car to be found for whatever reason? That there's sort of a change in plan on that.
Yeah, I mean, the car being found where it was found, if it had been found there a couple days prior, it would have helped substantiate what Ken said Sharon was up to that night. But because it showed up a few days later, it's a little less supportive, I suppose. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it was in a place I love, by the way, that where he was the night of the murder just so happens to be the same places where she would be. That's
right.
Oh, yeah.
I keep having to circle back and check the season title because I'm like, it's not versus yeah. Ken Jackson. Who the fuck are we talking about?
Oh, believe me.
That's the real plot twist in the whole story. We're getting there. We're going to be there very soon. We'll be there very soon.
Right. And if the car is found in Nashua or it's found at a different business, you're right. It does change the whole narrative from Ken about what he thought his wife was doing. You know, this also came up, and I'm trying to remember, Robbie, which one of the witnesses said this, but we've established that Ken has a pattern of obsessively calling around where Sharon may be, right? If she's at a friend's house, he is calling to make sure that she is there. The night she goes missing and the morning afterwards, he's not doing that at all. So again,
yeah, no, there was more than one witness. It was literally almost everybody she knew. It was her family members, it was her sister-in-law, right, brother-in-law, parents, other friends who said that he would call, like, if she was supposed to be home by a time she gave and she wasn't, like 5 minutes up beyond that, like he started making calls. And then the other thing is, like, you know, he tells the police he's home by around 9:30, but then he also says that, okay, he fell asleep a little bit later, let's say 11 or 12, right? He kind of goes back and forth on that. Even if he thinks Sharon went to the mall, you know, Sears is not open at 11 o'clock at night, right? It's like,
right,
at some point he's got to be like, where could she have gone? Even if she went shopping, even if she did all the things that she might. Although here's one thing I have to point out is that Ken never told the police ever in any of his statements. If you go back and listen to the episodes, I know it's a lot of details to remember, that Sharon said when she called him, that final call she made from work, that she was going shopping. She said, mm-hmm, I have to stay a little longer to work on some stuff with these engineers, and then I'm going to go to this place in Tyngsborough, Massachusetts to do with my lottery stuff. He himself never mentions that she might go shopping. That information comes from coworkers that she mentioned it to. So if Ken never tells that to the police, that either means he doesn't know it or he doesn't want to tell them. Now, here's the thing. You might remember at the end of this past episode, and I, you know, it might have slipped past you, he stops and he tells Mary Lou that her car has disappeared from the mall. That means Ken did know she was going to the mall. Like, right, nobody has told him that, by the way, her coworker said she was going shopping. And nobody at this point has even spoken to a single employee at the mall and confirmed in this timeline that Sharon was at the mall. But these are the muddy foot. Remember the last addendum? I love what Sarah Kalin said. She's like, it's like he keeps trying to clean up his muddy footprints and just making more. This is him, mm-hmm, just making all kinds of shitty footprints everywhere. He keeps saying stuff that he has no way of knowing, really.
Right, right. One of the things we heard that Sharon did is that she left work and she drove south into Massachusetts. Tyngsboro is a border town, to buy lottery tickets. And I don't know if you guys remember, but it used to be that there were different lotteries in different states. So if you had a game that all of a sudden, you know, the jackpot builds, if it's in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, you can't get that, and vice versa. And this is like the days when you'd have huge lines, people trying to go into a convenience store. So the idea that she would go to Massachusetts to get her lottery tickets, even if it was the place that she always went, I mean, I can see that. Yeah, there were, you know, scratch tickets, and I think New Hampshire was a mega bucks state or a mega million state, and then they had, tri-state mega bucks, and then they had, Massachusetts mega bucks in Massachusetts. So it's kind of, as somebody that once did a PR for a state lottery,
You know a lot about it.
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating. But now, the past 10 years, they did away with that, where if you were one state, you couldn't, you know, this kind of lottery, you couldn't be a different kind of lottery. It's kind of like when you go to a restaurant, you get Coke or Pepsi, but you can't get both, right? So now there were Powerball states, and then there were Mega Million states, and you could only be one or the other. And then they sort of merged them together. Mm. So now, like on Tuesday, you know, there's like a whole other jackpot. They want to get these jackpots up to like 20 million, 50 million, so that it goes faster that way. But the thing is, now there's nothing unique in your state as far as a lottery product. So today, if she wanted that big jackpot, she wouldn't have to go to Tyngsboro.
Yeah.
She
could stay. This is for the younger listeners out there. Yeah, this is a history lesson. Yeah, I remember I had like maybe a 6 month period in my life where I got a little bit like into lottery stuff and I realized this is a thing. And then after 6 months, I'm like, I'm not wasting another $20 on that, you know, and that was it. But I remember that. I remember the different states, like, you know, like Virginia would have a different like pot and Maryland would have a different. Yeah, yeah. And so there must have been something going on in Massachusetts where like they just had and that's where they wanted to play. So she played numbers for her colleagues too, almost every week.
Yeah, Amber, I'm sure that you threw $5 in the office pool when the no. lottery got pretty big.
So I used to work at the Detroit Free Press. I left there in 2010. I am still part of a work lottery there. It's going to happen someday, people.
It's like fantasy football, but it's every Tuesday and Thursday or whatever.
We should have like a true crime podcasters pool or something.
See, the problem is that if you win, then everybody quits, you know? So yeah. I always did the office pool because I thought, do I want to be the one who, like, everybody wins and quits, and then I'm stuck here with Thelma, who I don't like, and she can't do anything, and we're looking at each other like, oh, man. So anyway, back to the case. Yeah. Robbie, remind us who Margaret O'Brien is.
Margaret O'Brien is a woman who worked at Kmart, which was not far from Mall of New Hampshire, and she's the one who saw that night on the night that Sharon was murdered, driving on Auto Center Road, is what it was called, by Frank Yankos, or Yankos, Yankos.
Frank Yanko, by the way, thank you for putting in the vintage Frank Yanko TV commercial. I was like, oh, if only I wanted to buy a Pontiac in 1988. Yeah, yeah, it was wonderful.
Well, you know, the real reason I put that in was because at the very end of the ad, and I think it originally got edited out, but we added it back in. At the very end of it, the ad, he says, the guy says in the ad, right next to the Mall in New Hampshire. So I wanted to show the proximity of the Mall in New Hampshire to that. But also, it was a great vintage ad. He apparently was a character. There's some cool ads with him. But anyway, yeah, so she saw this car that was parked, like, literally just blocking the road, at one lane of the road. She had to, like, drive around it. And there was a pregnant woman standing outside. There was a man who was kind of a head taller than her, pressing her against a car. The woman was saying no. It was clearly not... There was something was going on, right? It was a situation that caught her attention. As Margaret drove by, the guy turned and looked at her in the face. So she, I mean, she drove by close enough that she, her window being down, and her window was down, she remembered some great details that the Sally Jesse Raphael show was on. She turned it off. I was like, I wish we got a timestamp for that. But we do have Margaret's work record, so we know what time she left work. She left work at 9:30 that night. So this happened right after, and it was a hot night. Her windows rolled down. So when she passed them, they were pretty close to her. Like, she was looking right at him.
Right.
Yeah. And she positively identified, when she was shown a picture of Sharon, that that was the woman she saw.
Yeah. And so Amber is, I think Robbie explained, that Kmart is across the street from the Mall of New Hampshire. Very easy to walk to. If there was a confrontation and Sharon's car had been over at Kmart, it would be very easy to move it to the Mall of New Hampshire, where it's more likely to be seen and discovered and fits with a certain timeline, and move back. Does that raise your spidey sense?
There's a lot that raises my spidey sense. I was curious. Okay, so the man that she described wasn't wearing the same kind of clothes that I think it was Melanie said he was wearing. Did Ken have tan arms?
I'm assuming he did. He worked outdoors a lot. He had a wood splitting business at one point. He just kept trying to, you know, but when and if he worked, it was always outdoors. So, and you know, this is summertime, so I'm assuming his arms were tan. I mean, the way she described him, minus the sideburns, although maybe it's dark and the hair is kind of shaggy, you can't tell. Mm-hmm. Seems it's the right height. It's the right build. It's the right hairstyle. Ken had... I mean, people describe looking at Kenny Loggins. Remember that Kenny Loggins hair with the, right. It was like kind of like bangs and then kind of like a little longer in the back. I had a little bit of a thing. Yeah, I had a little thing for Kenny Loggins back in the day. But anyway,
so many secrets come out on the addendum. I love it.
I know. So many dark secrets. But you know, she actually wasn't, okay, initially, and I didn't include this because it's hard to know, like, when you're overwhelming your audience and what details to keep in and out. She told the police she couldn't make a composite, so she gave a general description.
Right.
It turned out later that she admitted that she was scared. She said that she's like, I can give a composite, but I was just kind of scared. I didn't want to because I didn't know what was going on and this woman was murdered. But she said she didn't even have to give a composite because she said when she saw, well, she did eventually, but she said when she saw Ken Johnson on the news, she's like, that is the guy I saw that night.
Right. Yeah, which I can see. You know, yeah. Certainly if you know some of the details and you're wondering, well, pregnant woman goes missing, I saw a pregnant woman in some kind of confrontation, that two and two would go together pretty quickly. I'm going to go to a question from Carrie on Twitter. I talked about this a little bit, but she takes this question one step further. She says, in retrospect, it's clear that Ken's not calling around to look for his wife on the night she was missing was a break from a pattern of control and surveillance. Was this break in the pattern noted by police at the time? Do you see that in the files, Rabia?
Oh, 100%. I mean, yeah. It comes up again and again, and I mean, it comes up usually in the context of a police, the police taking a statement. But, you know, like when you have these police statements, they're kind of summarizing this conversation. It's not a transcript.
Right.
But the fact that it's included like every time to me means it is something that the police found significant that they needed to put in their report. It is, they're trying to establish a pattern of behavior between this couple. What is their dynamic? What is their relationship like? And then what's a break in that, right? So, or what could be a change in that? I absolutely think it was 100% on their radar.
Now, can you tell us about the morning of Saturday, July 30th, when the Johnsons' friends visited Ken to try to comfort her? What was the big takeaway for you from that?
Well, there's a couple things that was happening. Number one, that's the morning the police started some surveillance on Ken. It was very short-lived surveillance. It was, I still don't understand why they decided we're going to show up Saturday morning, like around 11 or 12 and survey him for until like 3 or 4 or 5. And that's literally it, period. Like they never survey him before that, after that. The reason it becomes significant is actually has to do with once we do get to the title of this series, Station Carol, and how they work Jason into the case. So what happened Saturday morning at Ken Johnson's, it's going to be part of the state's theory about how Jason participated in the crime. So it's kind of important to know. But beyond that, you know, after these friends visited him, you know, the Stengels were like, we need to talk to the police. Something is really weird here. And, you know, they didn't know it was weird because they don't know. This is literally the day after Ken was told that his wife is murdered like 5 p.m. the night before. This is the next morning, like 11, 12 o'clock. They have no idea what he's told the police the night before in terms of his movements. But the story he tells them is completely, within hours, different than what he tells the police. That screams something to me, right? And actually, I want to go back to something that was related to the Margaret O'Brien thing. Margaret O'Brien left work at 9:30. She's between 9:30 and 9:40. I mean, it took a few minutes for her to get to Auto Center Road, whatever. You know, maybe she aired out her car a few. But by 9:40, she probably saw this couple. If Ken is insisting he's home by 9:30 instead of saying after 10, why? Like, why is he he's so many things change in his statement, but he always makes sure to put himself home by 9:30. That says a lot to me. So these little timing issues, you know, that he keeps fudging, they're all for a reason. It's not random.
There's a tweet from Karen. She asks, if the police are surveilling Ken's house after his wife's death, why would they not get a warrant to search the house? They obviously were suspicious. Robbie, before you answer that, Amber, what do you think?
Just hear, hear. Like, I don't understand this at all. There's so many. There's like a list of life lessons I want to take from this season. If your partner gets weirded out because you're 5 minutes late, know that that's a red flag.
Right.
If he's like that and then he doesn't call around when you're missing, also a red flag, means he killed you. And then, I mean, they're just all of these. And that one is like, if I didn't, I assume that by now we would know if Ken has some kind of friendship with police officers. So it's very confusing to me why they wouldn't have searched the obvious place. Like, you don't even have to be suspicious of the husband to want to search the victim's home.
Mm-hmm. Well, Robbie, do you feel that there was enough evidence for a search warrant that a judge would sign off based on suspicion, at least in this moment?
Easily. They got a search warrant. They got a search warrant executed for his car.
Right.
And if they were able to make a case for the car, they can make a case for the house. When they're missing evidence or missing the victim's purse, a shirt, you know, maybe a weapon, like easily they could have gotten it. It, you know, it's interesting. You know, my research assistant, Jennifer, has messaged me and I'm just like, girl, I don't know what to tell you. She keeps saying, why? But why didn't they search to help? I was like, I don't have an answer other than it seems to be an absolutely unbelievable glaring oversight in the investigation. I mean, like, that's literally the only thing. I don't understand it. There is no explanation for it. It absolutely didn't happen. They never searched the house. They didn't search his bins. Literally, her purse could have been in the bin outside. But this is also something that Jen raised with me, that you said, Amber, that was Ken connected? No, he was a complete loser who had zero connections to anything. Mm-hmm. he just got really lucky. I'm not saying there's something definitely in the house. We don't know, but we also just don't know.
Right. You had a cliffhanger, which was that in Ken's car, among the items found was a utility knife. Laura asks, will there be more discussion about the items found in Ken's car?
Oh, definitely. We're going to get to that in one episode when we actually talk about like the actual evidence in the case, like what we do know. And it's not the knife that the police decide is the murder weapon. There's another knife that comes into the story. And so once we get into the knife discussions and comparing the knives and all that and trying to figure out what happened, we are going to get to it. That knife, but I just had to put out there that the night his wife was murdered, they found a knife in his car.
We have another question from at Cognac Cork. I like that name. The question was the gender of the baby known? Y'all keep mentioning how Sharon and Ken were hoping for a son, and I think that was one of the things, actually, that Ken first said, I think, to the cops, was she was carrying my son. If Sharon was having a daughter and Ken was disappointed, this could be a possible motive, couldn't it? Any indication that they knew what the gender of their baby was?
This is a complicated question, and that's actually a whole – I'm going to do a whole section on this very issue, but I totally agree with Cognac Cork that it's an important question. It's important to examine, to figure out what was happening in the marriage and in Ken's mind. And from the case files, it wasn't very clear as I was going. It wasn't until I started talking to people, and I promise you listeners, you'll hear the audio, that we got some more clarity around it. But y'all have to wait for that.
Well, I think my mom had my little sister in 85, and it was a surprise what the gender was. I don't think it was as common to test early back then, but I don't know if, you know, a few years later it had started to get more commonplace, you know?
There was no big gender reveal party where she blew up a cake and...
Yeah, and set California on fire.
No. Exactly. But Amber, you also know from your experience covering other crimes that one of the most dangerous times for a woman is when she is pregnant, and that has to do with her intimate partner. And it can sometimes be, right, that he doesn't want to be a father or something else related to the impending birth. So would it not be an interesting avenue to pursue?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'll be listening to that section.
Also, Cognac Cork asked, additionally, do we know who Ken called while at Mary Lou's also? Also, when exactly did Buddy drive Ken to Merrimack? Was it the same Friday evening? I bet Sharon's car was there. So two questions there. I'll just take the first. Robbie, anything about who Ken might have called at Mary Lou's place?
Yeah, Ken called Sharon's brother, Ken Eaton, that night. And said, I'm at a neighbor, you know, neighbor Mary Lou Farrow's house. And so the next morning, Saturday morning, when all those friends came over and Ken Eaton, Sharon's brother, came over to the house, the Johnson house, that's when he spoke to Ken's brother, Tom Johnson. I know there's so many names, and said, oh yeah, so apparently Ken went out last night. And he's like, yeah, he went out to see a friend last night. And so they both, you know, Ken Johnson's brother had spent the night with him. They were home. If he was going to offer the witness to the police that I was home on it, it was going to be his brother and sister-in-law who would stay the night with him. So yeah, I mean, he called his own brother-in-law and said that I'm out. And so either actually it was like maybe a few days later when he was asked about that visit and he lied, he might've forgotten that he made that phone call. Ken was drunk a lot. He was drunk a lot.
Well, what was the Johnsons' relationship with Ken like in the days after Sharon's death? Were they terribly suspicious?
You know, it's interesting, and I think it's one of those things where it's hard to know now. People say, oh, I knew this immediately, or I knew that immediately, but kind of like maybe it's just hindsight is coloring them. But the folks I spoke to, most of them were like, oh, we just knew it immediately. And I think they did immediately feel like there was something there, because they kept, like, Sharon's brother and his wife, Diane, they kept contacting the police and said, we want to tell you more. We want to, like, they kept reporting on Ken Johnson to the police. So definitely they felt suspicious.
By the way, can I say that Melanie probably should be an investigator? She checked the toothbrush to see if it was wet, and she checked the laundry. I was freaking, how old was she at the time?
14.
Genius.
Yeah. And so apparently Sharon Johnson had some kind of a dental condition. And because of that condition, and she had just been to the dentist 2 days before she was killed and got a cleaning. And because of that condition, she was like vigilant about brushing. Like she never, you know what I mean? Like, so, but you're right. It's amazing. I don't think my kids would ever think of that at that age, or anybody, even adults wouldn't think of that.
You got to remember at the time there was no CSI to watch and learn. It was Miami Vice.
Right. We did have Unsolved Mysteries though.
Oh, that's right.
I remember
right.
watching that with my mom. Yeah. So.
Right. And Quincy.
I have no recollection of Quincy.
You know, Jack Klugman is Quincy, the medical examiner?
Mm-mm, never saw it.
Amber, back me up. You've seen this, right?
I'm sorry, Kevin.
Are you kidding me?
Kevin, is this from like the 1950s or something?
Oh my God. Your executive producer, Methil, just popped in and she said she remembers. She gave me the nod. She remembers Quincy. Hey, fun fact about Quincy is that he was the only main character in television history whose first name you didn't know. He was just known as Quincy or Dr. Quincy. They just called him Quincy. He was kind of a...
It was Madonna before Madonna, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, well, isn't he had one name, but no one ever referred to his first name. It was just a little thing about him.
I love it.
So episode 3 seemed to imply that Sharon's daughter was immediately suspicious and, in fact, seemed to catch Ken in a lie about sleeping at home. So I'm wondering if the police or authorities heard her suspicions at the time and took it seriously, this 14-year-old.
I don't know how suspicious she felt of Ken, to be honest. I don't think any of the kids thought that, because all of them reported, the two that I've spoken to, Lisa and Melanie, that they'd never seen Ken be violent. He was basically pretty decent with them. Mm-hmm. And I think it would have been really hard for them to believe that something like this could happen. And they all reported that you know, everybody was excited about the baby. Sure, there were problems, but she also thought that Ken and Sharon had an amazing relationship because they were always, like, you know, locked up in a bedroom getting it on. So I don't think she necessarily was. Melanie was suspicious. Melanie, her suspicion was that her mother didn't come home last night.
Right.
It wasn't that her mom came home and went to work. That's where she was suspicious. I don't think she was suspicious that Ken did it. But over time, she remembered little things. Like, she told the police a few weeks out, I think, from the murder that, oh, she remembered another detail, which was that that Thursday morning when she got up and her mom wasn't home and was like, oh, did mom already leave? Ken said, yeah, not only did she leave, but she's going to be home late because she's going to meet a friend at the mall. Mm-hmm. Again, one more instance in which Ken apparently had knowledge that Sharon might be going to the mall and on purpose did not tell the police that's what his wife's last movements were known to. Like, that's what he knew of his wife's last movements. So, yeah, I mean, and I think the police were noticing things and then trying to extract information from Melanie, like about the strong box, right? They go to Ken's house and they see that he is, like, they're, you know, Ken's like, oh, yeah, well, all of these credit cards and financial information that's already with my lawyer, and it was in the strong box, and he points to the strong box, and Sexton was bright enough that he was just like, huh. He, I guess, got a sense that I should ask more about the strong box. He didn't just take it for granted that Ken would have a key to it. He was a good investigator. And so he went back to Melanie, who was like, let me ask you about the keys to this. Do you know anything about who would have the keys? And so as Melanie's responding, honestly, she has no idea. Because Melanie actually has not been living with Ken since this happened. She's been living with her father. She's come home back and forth. She has no idea that Ken is at home with the strong box open. She's just responding to the police's questions.
Amber, if I could pick you up and drop you right into 1988 as a newspaper reporter, and suppose you got the case here Saturday after the car is found. I'm curious, where are you going? Whose door are you knocking on? Are you going to Ken's or are you going someplace else?
No, I'm going to Ken's. Well, first, I always like to go to the people around.
Right.
Because you find out that he said that he went for a walk and he called so-and-so, so that you're, you know, armed with all this extra knowledge before you talk to the person that you're really interested in. But of course, by the way, you triggered another life lesson memory for me. Just because a dude satisfies you doesn't mean he's your soulmate. That's also ladies, please keep that in mind.
Amber Hunt, life coach. I think forget crimes of the century. I think you should just...
I just wanted to hug her when I heard that. Yeah.
But I'll be honest. There are machines
that can help. You don't need him.
I'll be honest, though. You know, I think there were some questions about that narrative as well. I think that might have been something that Sharon was telling her family and friends as they're wondering, why the hell are you with this guy? And he's got no redeeming values. And we all hate him. And that was the one thing she could offer. I don't think that's necessarily true. And there's at least one interview in which it seems to be not that Sharon's the one who constantly wants it, but it's Ken.
That also, you know, if your friend tells you that that's the reason they're with somebody, lecture them. You don't need to stay for that.
That can't be it. Yeah.
Right. Right. And as a guy in my lizard brain, what I think is that if I have a partner who is going to do it all the time or on demand or whatever, if that suddenly stops, I'm going to be really disappointed. Now, I'm not homicidal, but for some people, I should say for some dudes, you know, that is enough to, you know, spark a huge argument, which could go anywhere.
I mean, there's a reason that sex is considered a motive in many cases. So,
right. Karen wants to know, remind us who the woman who was helping Ken write thank you notes is, and what does she have to do with anything?
Oh yeah, so that's Kathy Hampson. Kathy Hampson is, I mean, of all of Sharon's best friends, maybe her closest best friend, only because they saw each other most frequently. Literally, she was always over at her house. They hung out a few times a week. So Kathy spent a lot of time with Ken in at least maybe a couple of weeks after the murder, and then maybe she stopped. But she was just there to support him. And, you know, Kathy was somebody the police started wondering about a little bit. Like, they were suspicious, and they wondered, they were even floating the theory that maybe Ken was having a relationship with Kathy. Maybe there was an affair behind this, right? But it really didn't amount to anything. But something happens at the funeral, which is kind of weird. And we're going to get into that actually episode five. We're going to get into what happens at the funeral, and Kathy has to do with that. What happens at the funeral that makes the police really suspicious of her. Just suspicious in general. So we're going to get to that episode five. That's why Kathy just happened to be there. When Sexton dropped by, it was just Ken and Kathy at the house. And so that's how I reported it.
Yeah, it's okay to bounce around in the chronological narrative. Kathy's there writing thank you notes after the funeral. You're going to tell us what happened at the funeral that is going to be interesting to your story.
Yeah, because the police at this point are not that interested in what happens at the funeral. It's not until a new investigator takes the lead. And it's an investigator, apparently, everybody in New Hampshire in the legal community, the minute you say his name, their eyes light up. So once he comes on board, he's just like digging up dead bodies all over the place. Yeah, he's the one who's like, what happened at that funeral? And so we're going to, it seems chronologically not happening in order, but it kind of is, because it doesn't become very relevant until this guy steps in.
Well, I think that the way you're telling this story this season is super compelling, because, Amber, sometimes, you know, these stories aren't exactly a whodunit. And even though you have a strong suspicion and that just the hearing the details and sort of the story, how it goes along and what is happening is enough to make it really, really interesting to you as a listener.
Oh, right. For sure. Yeah. One of the craziest things as a listener for me was hearing the investigator talk about how how much of an impression that first interview made on him, you know, that he didn't seem to have any emotion. And I'm always careful with that stuff too. People handle trauma and shock and all of that. But for whatever reason, it stuck with him. And yet the season is called Versus Jason Carroll. So I'm very eager. I made a point not to, to Google. I don't know. I feel a little funny, like, not giving myself spoilers on a true crime, but you're, you're telling it in a really compelling way. So I'm going to go along with the ride.
Well, you can't give a twist in the third episode, the major twist, right? Because you have to build up to something. And we do have a great twist coming, as I, as I'm sure even those who don't Google can anticipate something coming up, because it is undisclosed after all. And, you know, we know what to expect.
I promise you, it's a 10-episode season. The second half, we're going to hear a lot about Jason and what happened to him. But I think, to me, the reason I laid it out, the craziest part of the story is, like, you're looking at everything that's happening with Ken. And I want to make that very clear to the audience that this is what the police are working with. And they end up with Jason Carroll. Like, right. You know. Yeah. Oh, it's going to get worse. You're not even going to believe it.
So you've kind of tipped your hand about episode 5 a little bit. What can we expect in episode 4?
Episode 4 might be one of my favorite episodes.
Really? Okay.
Only because it's one of the so Ken is both, Ken is deeply stupid, but he also thinks he's a criminal mastermind. And so he is just trying to throw the police for loops. And he throws them for this loop. He sends them on a wild goose chase after a lead that is nearly to this day, even as I'm writing it, it is so hard for me to believe the police took any of it seriously at any time. And it's a crazy story. So we're going to hear about a character named Bob, and the episode's going to be called What About Bob? And it's going to be a ride.
Connection.
Yeah, it's going to be a ride.
So before we wrap this up, there was one more tweet that came in to you, Rabia. Any update on Adnan? Yeah. I remember seeing in May you had big news but couldn't share it at the time. I assume you still can't, but was hoping for an up-to-date expected timeline, if possible. Praying hand. What do you got for us?
If you know anything about me, if there's anything I can share about Adnan, I will be the first to, like, bust wide open online. Like, I can't keep it in. But I also know how to mind the lawyers, and that's what I'm doing. So just because it's silent doesn't mean stuff isn't happening. A lot is happening. It's just not a lot that we can share. But the minute we can share, not only are we going to share it, we'll probably do a whole episode on Undisclosed about it. So I promise you, if you're listening to Undisclosed, you will definitely hear about it. But if you follow me online, there's no way you'll escape it when it happens. As far as the timeline, I really do think it's going to be this fall sometime. But, you know, every time I, like, kind of push his lawyer, I get a little bit of, like, yeah, we're getting there. I'm like, dang it, just give me a date. but I can't give it, and I understand.
It's good because we are in this fall right now, so
we are, and so it can't be too far off.
Well, Amber Hunt, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the Undisclosed Addendum.
Thank you.
We cannot wait for your next season of Accused.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited.
And Rabia, I guess we will tune in next week for another great episode and another edition of Addendum.
Yep. What about Bob?
So if you have questions about this case or any of the other cases covered on Undisclosed, you can ask them on social media. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Thanks so much to executive producer Mithil Talhan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for letting me be part of their work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come next week.